This is the current federal tax developments for the week of November the 16th, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'm broadcasting this week from Phoenix, Arizona again. We're going to talk about what's happened this week in the area of federal taxes. Our topics this week, first we're going to start and talk about the IRS issued a ruling, or we're told they're going to be issuing a ruling regarding the status of those expenses that we have paid that we can use to get forgiveness from the PPP loan we might have received, but for which we may not have either applied or gotten any sort of information on whether we will be allowed to claim forgiveness on those items by the end of the year. Also, we're going to have a second issue where the IRS tells us about how we're going to deal with those entity-level taxes that some states like Connecticut, Wisconsin, Oklahoma, New Jersey have passed to work around the limitation on deduction for state and local taxes by having business entities that are pass-throughs pay tax at the entity level and then providing some sort of a credit or keeping it off the return for the state return or some other way to make good so that we effectively deduct the taxes above the line on the federal return, allowing a full deduction without the $10,000 limit. We're going to discover the IRS effectively is going to throw in the towel on that one and tell us they're going to allow those deductions. Finally, we're going to talk about a case that came up this week where a taxpayer tried to claim that his single member LLC was acting as an agent for his IRA custodian, and it would have allowed him, in his view, to use the funds, therefore, that were in the IRA to make investments to purchase loans, you know, kind of private loans to be paid back and go back into the IRA. So we'll talk about how the courts felt about that particular issue. But let's start out with an article that appeared this week in Tax Notes Today Federal, written by Eric Yock. And the article talks about the issues and is entitled PPP Borrowers Brace for Potentially Problematic IRS Guidance. The article was found in Tax Notes Today Federal on November the 14th. If you remember, when we first got the PPP loan program, that was found in the CARES Act, and as first written, the law provided that when we got our loan, we would have 8 weeks to spend the money on things that would, if we spent the appropriate things and didn't cut our employees' hours by too much, didn't reduce their salaries or wage rates by too much, we would be able to get forgiveness by using it for appropriate expenses. And we also had that this loan we would not pay tax on, or we would not have to start paying on the loan, paying any principal or interest on it, for 6 months. So at that point, under that program, you had this program, which presumably if you were not a fiscal year taxpayer, you were a calendar year taxpayer, the odds were that you were going to spend it because you got this loan in late May, early June. You were going to spend it, right, over 8 weeks. You would then want to go ahead and apply for your forgiveness. So hopefully you had the entire loan forgiven before that 6 month period ran. So in that environment, on April the 30th, the IRS issued guidance on what happens to the loan, to expenses paid that are reimbursed by that loan for tax purposes. The CARES Act had provided in Section 1106I that the actual forgiveness of the loan would not be considered taxable income to the borrower. That was a specific line item. But the law did not say anything about what happened to those expenses. In Notice 2020-32, the IRS decided that those expenses represented expenses related to tax-exempt income, seeing the cancellation of debt on the PPP loan that was not going to be included in income as being tax-exempt income. And as such, under Section 265A1, no deduction would be allowed to the taxpayer for any expenses paid that came from those tainted funds. Now, that position was one that did not exactly thrill the chairs of the tax writing committees, either Senator Grassley or Representative Neal. It also didn't thrill a number of other members of Congress, though not all were unanimous in believing that the guidance was in error. But regardless, we have the Treasury telling us this. Now, at that point, remember, In theory, because of short time frames, it's pretty clear that calendar year taxpayers, which are going to make up the largest group, they would most likely already know before they filed the return, if they didn't want to go ahead and start paying on the loan, they would have already known by that point whether or not they would have had forgiveness and what amount. So we didn't really have a problem of hitting the end of the year for most taxpayers and not yet having a decision on whether the debt had been forgiven. But when Congress passed the Paycheck Protection Program Flexibility Act in June of this year, that all changed. Under that program, we had 24 weeks. For 24 weeks to spend the money instead of 8. So we tripled our time frame to spend the money. And then the other thing that happened was the law also changed to say we would not have to pay any principal or interest on the loan as long until we got a decision on forgiveness, as long as we applied for forgiveness no later than 10 months after the end of our 24-week covered period. Well, that's, you know, at that point now, when you think 24 weeks plus 10 months, there are going to be a lot of people that will not need to apply for forgiveness before the end of December. As well, Congress kept talking about adding a provision that would give some sort of automatic relief or self-certification that qualify for forgiveness for loans up to $150,000. Now, because of that, the banks, looking at two things, number one, people did not have to apply for forgiveness until 10 months after the end of 24 weeks, so there's no rush from their perspective to have applications open for forgiveness, and number two, we might be able to get rid of the vast majority of our loans and only have to deal with really big ones where we'll have to do a lot of work to verify documents they send us. So a lot of the big banks have been slow walking, shall we say, the ability to go around and apply for your loan forgiveness. So in many cases, those large banks, even today, borrowers cannot start the application process for forgiveness. We also discovered when the SBA put their guidance out on the forgiveness process that it might take up to 150 days for us to get a final decision. The bank would have 60 days to decide, you know, what they thought based upon what we submitted as to how much we should be forgiven of the loan. And then they would submit their decision to the SBA, who would then have 90 days to look over that and review it. So if both parties took the maximum period of time to review, it could take 150 days to get the item reviewed. And since there were over 5 million of these loans outstanding, there's a reasonable concern that when the applications start going fast and furious in, that the process could get overloaded and we could be getting very, very close to that 150 day period. So suddenly it became a question of, you know, we're going to have a lot of taxpayers who have not applied for forgiveness or have not received a determination on forgiveness when they get to the end of their tax year, because we're rapidly approaching that now. You know, we're sitting here in the middle of November, so we got a month and a half before we hit the end of the year, the date by which we're going to essentially cut off the tax year for the largest number of PPP borrowers. And the question becomes, what do we do about those expenses we paid that could be used to offset the PPP, that could be used to justify the cancellation of the PPP loan, but we've yet to submit and had a determination made on those amounts? And we're not totally sure either if they're going to work, because as we've also been very aware, it's not being clear during any of this, you know, the situation of the SBA has kind of dribs and drabs have come out on guidance. So we've had slow pieces come out, and every so often something surprising comes out, as came out at the end of August, when we suddenly discovered that if you were paying rent payments to a landlord, where there was any common ownership between the landlord and the borrower who was leasing the property, that we were going to have some rather strict limits on how much we could claim as a forgivable expense that were not going to be tied to just to a reasonable rent payment that would have been paid to a third party, but rather would have had to look through and been capped at the proportion of the mortgage interest that was payable. So we have surprises. So there is some reasonable concern that I don't know for sure, even if I spent money on things that I think were going to qualify, are there going to be other gotchas that come up? And so maybe I'm not so sure. So the question becomes, what do we do about those expenses that were paid after we got the loan, before the end of the 24-week covered period, but which, you know, we've not yet had our application submitted, or we just haven't had action on it? And so the AI CPA has been asking the IRS, what do you do in that case? Do you go ahead and claim the deduction? And then when we get forgiveness, do we then have some sort of tax benefit recapture? Or do we have to figure out this year, you know, are we going to lose the deduct? You know, are we going to get forgiveness? And if we think we're going to, do we have to not, you know, basically not claim those deductions? So the AICPA did finally recently, and they began talking about this. The Tax Note article talks about this and quotes Ed Carl there. I also was on a program on November the 7th for the Washington Society of CPAs Pacific Tax Conference. It was a virtual conference, and the speaker just before me on the conference was the same Ed Carl from the AICPA. And, you know, he repeated this information for that conference as well. So what we have is the AICPA has been told by the IRS that they plan to issue guidance that says if you have these amounts you paid for a PPP loan and you've gotten to the end of your tax year and you have not applied for or have not received notification of the amount of forgiveness you're going to get, that as long as you reasonably expect to receive forgiveness for certain expenses that you paid before the end of the year, that those should not be deducted on the return. Now, the IRS, you know, so the IRS says you don't use a tax benefit method. Rather, you know, you're just going to say, we think it's going to be done. So because of that, our reasonable expectation is we're going to get forgiveness. And presumably, you've been spending based on what you reasonably expect would be forgiven. So the theory would be, for most taxpayers, you would have to not claim that deduction. Now, as Ed Carl notes in the program and was, you know, as he's noted in numerous places, also, I believe, on the AICPA's town hall, there are a number of practitioners and a number of people on AICPA committees or AICPA task forces that don't necessarily agree with this view. And we'll talk about what the issue is. But this guidance, which, again, is going to probably be in the form of a notice similar to Notice 20-2032, or similar item, that kind of thing, not going to be a reg, it's going to be sitting sub-regulatory guidance of some sort. The AICPA says it should be out by the end of the year, and the IRS may even work to get it out before the end of November, understanding that people are coming up on tax planning, and you're going to need to kind of work with this concept. But as I say, it's not clear that this particular analysis is necessarily the correct or only analysis. Those who are, you know, advocating most strongly, saying that no, this is wrong, tend to point to a case from the U.S. Supreme Court, which was decided years ago back in, let me get back to my citation here, the Bliss-Derry case decided in 1983, which was United States versus Bliss-Derry, decided the U.S. Supreme Court, citation 460 U.S. 370. The Bliss-Derry case, which they say holds for the fact that this should be, that this falls under the tax benefit rule provision as outlined by Bliss-Derry. Now, I'll give you a little history of Bliss-Derry. And the interesting part is it really is a corporate liquidation case under the liquidation rules that were in place prior to the 1986 Tax Act. So in one sense, you might think, what does that have to do with anything? But it has to do with this. So I'll give you a quick summary of what went on with Bliss-Derry. Bliss-Derry was a dairy located in Phoenix, Arizona. It had a fiscal year end of June 30. And so for the fiscal year ended June 30, 1973, it was a dairy. You know, they raised, you know, they had the cattle, right? So they're raising, you know, they got the cattle there for the milk. And so they got the dairy herd. So as a lot of farming types would do, you know, they come up to year end, they bought a bunch of feed. They're able to report an agricultural entity at that time, and today even, they report on the cash basis, and they expense that feed up front. In fact, back when I first got it started in practice, you know, there were like cattle feeding shelters whose whole theory was based on, you know, getting outside investors to buy into these herds because it could take advantage with a brand new herd of paying for the feed the first year without having any income, which means we got a big write-off in year one. right? I mean, it will catch up eventually, but you know, at those days, they were selling shelters based on how much they would save you this year. So we had those kind of cattle feeding tax shelters, which, by the way, tended to have problems, but hey, you know, that's how it went. But in any event, so they do that. Legally under the law, they claim the deduction. 2 days into the next year, like on July 2nd of 1973, so 2 days after the close of that fiscal year, they execute a, you know, they sign up for the articles, you know, for documents, for a plan of going to be of liquidation of the corporation, which at that time you could conduct, and it was a tax-free structure. So the corporation did not pay any tax on any on gains on any items sold, nor did it pay tax if it just distributed the assets to the shareholders. In this case, they were effectively just going to stop operating in corporate form and start operating as, I presume, going to be a partnership running a farming activity. So they kicked it out that way. And what happened under the law at that time was, they also, the method they chose to use, which allowed it under the law at that time, said in that liquidation that if you did what was called a one-month liquidation, we also could avoid to some extent, depend upon the structure of earnings and profits, but you could avoid, you know, most or even all, or any, you could put paying tax on, you know, most or not pay tax on any potential gain on liquidation, because you would just allocate your basis of your stock to the assets that were there. Well, what that meant was this feed essentially got basis added back to it with no tax being paid, and therefore that basis got written off again as a, you know, going to be basically going to be written off again by the individual shareholders when we end up in the partnership actually consuming that fee, because it gets basis suddenly and we use it again. Now the question was, you know, did Bliss Dairy, you know, was this okay? Bliss claimed this big deduction when in fact we knew that we weren't really going to use, you know, we're going to say that fee didn't end up being used. And the Supreme Court, in an opinion authored by Sandra Day O'Connor, said, you know, yeah, there's a problem. But the problem is, you know, it was perfectly okay for Bliss Dairy to claim that deduction for the year ended June 30, 1973. But when the event occurred, the liquidation 2 days into the next year, that was not consistent with the reason why that deduction had been allowed initially, because we were going to consume that feed, that on that return, you would then pick up as a recapture the amount, you know, the proportion amount of the gain that had been avoided, because we, or the proportion amount of the deduction we had there. So we'd go ahead and reverse out the deduction, but we would reverse it out in that second year. Now, the case did not say, although it's not clear, it didn't say this because that was how the law would have worked, or it didn't say this because the IRS simply didn't argue that you should have gone back and disallowed it in the first year, the one for the June 30, 1973 year end, instead of letting it flow into the next year. But as we said, so we had this there, and the argument's going to come down very simply. In Bliss Dairy, it's clear. Obviously, it probably was not the case that at midnight on June 30th, 1973, that the officers, shareholders, etc., Bliss Dairy, were totally unaware that they planned to liquidate in 2 days. And then something happens, you know, the morning of the 2nd of July, they wake up and suddenly, hey, we need to liquidate today and get it done, right? Presumably, we can assume there's a real good chance that they knew it back in June that they were going to be liquidating early in the next year. In fact, that was part of the plan, probably, was how they're going to do it. So conceptually, the idea is, you know, the argument is, well, this is similar to the PPP loan. Even though we're going to apply in the following year, and we know that we are going, you know, maybe we feel really good that we're going to get that benefit of the offset, it still hasn't happened as of the end of the year, and we do have an annual accounting system for taxes. And so the idea would be, you know, the IRS told us under 265 that, well, you know, we really shouldn't, you know, we don't get that deduction. Their primary theory was because of that link to tax exempt income. Well, as people who are pushing the Bliss Dairy theory point out, we don't have any tax exempt income yet. right? We have a loan. We have to pay back a loan. That's never income unless it turns out we don't have to pay it back. So without tax-exempt income, the argument goes, there can be no exclusion under 265A1. That tax-exempt income occurs the next year. Bliss Dairy tells us what we're going to do is claim the deduction in the first year and claim the recapture, you know, capture it back under a tax benefit rule when we finally would get the forgiveness. Okay, now, obviously, the assumption is that the IRS will not agree with that. Whether the IRS will choose to tell us about Bliss Dairy and why Bliss Dairy is obviously wrong in their notice remains to be seen. It certainly seems a lot of people are telling the IRS about Bliss Dairy on this issue, so we'll have to watch how it goes. And there is a way the IRS may have telegraphed what their alternative method might be. In that notice 2020-32, the IRS did put forward an alternative theory about why these expenses that are going to be taken care of by the PPP loan proceeds and then forgiven, why we shouldn't be allowed deduction. And they go, their second theory, which is almost an afterthought, at the very end of the explanation, they said, well, and by the way, it also wouldn't be deductible because this represents expenses you are paying that you expect to be reimbursed. And if you have an expectation of reimbursement, then essentially you just don't get to claim the deduction. And you can think about this in the context of, you know, talking about an individual who has a right to be reimbursed expenses by their employer, let's say under an expense arrangement. Back when we could deduct employee business expenses, you couldn't claim the deduction because you had a right to be reimbursed. And even though you had not yet been reimbursed, you couldn't claim the deduction and then wait and pick up, you know, the next year under tax benefit, pick it up. Because they said, no, you had a right. There's no current economic loss to you because while you did spend this money, you also picked up this receivable. A receivable that you could, you know, get the money on demand. So because we have this receivable for reimbursement, expected reimbursement, the idea is we don't claim a deduction. Same thing true about partnership, you know, let's say by unreimbursed partner expenses for a partnership. Remember, we also don't get to claim that as a deduction unless we can show we don't have any, you know, in essence, we're not able to be reimbursed. The partnership will not reimburse us for the funds, the same theory. Obviously, the service could try to go that direction. Now, the problem we've got here is, what do we do if we've got a year-end return? Well, the catch is, I think you can argue either theory. Obviously, the IRS argued both theories, and I do agree with analysis, which was published, you know, this part of it, this two-option rule that I just described, was discussed in the article, and specifically in the case in question, the article quoted a quick analysis by Nathan Smith of CBIZ, who essentially, you know, gave this analysis and says, well, you know, you check which theory you're operating under for why it would be non-deductible. And if that theory is because of tax-exempt income, then, you know, we wait until forgiveness because we have to have our tax-exempt income first. If you're going to follow the IRS theory of reimbursement, then you would say, nope, it would be done in the current year. Well, realistically, if we actually get this notice as well from the IRS, but even if not, I think you need to have a conversation with your client about these options we have for these expenses. And, you know, which way do they want to go? Because it could change it by a taxpayer's, you know, what they feel about, you know, their risk tolerance, what type of tax positions they feel comfortable taking. Also, the issue about, you know, just, you know, how things work with them. It is their choice. But I would also suggest, though it's not a bad idea, is if you can put these taxpayers on extension, because we still have a reasonable chance that Congress will moot this point entirely by passing a bill that was going to allow you to claim these expenses. Certainly, there is a lot of support for that in the Congress. I think it's a majority support. It's bipartisan. So the problem is we have to find a bill to hook it to. Currently, the main party that does not want to have it done that way appears to be the Treasury Secretary, because, you know, he made that statement about this being tax 101 that you can claim no deduction. So keep your eye on this, but be aware we may have something coming out now, even if you might not like it. Next up, notice 2020-75. This is out, issued on November the 9th. A number of states, after we got the $10,000 cap on deductions for state and local taxes on Schedule A, remember there was a lot of talk about workarounds. Now, some states went out and did, quote, the tax credit workarounds, right, where you would make a contribution to a fund that would pay for certain state, you know, things that currently are being paid for by the general state revenues. And if you did that, you would get a credit against your state taxes. And the IRS moved quickly to shut that down. We have regulations now that basically have clamped down, and in the IRS's view, you can't do that. And they're probably correct in that view. But at the same time, another state went a little different way. Most of the states that are doing something went that tax credit route initially. But the state of Connecticut went a different route. They became mainly concerned about, okay, we can probably insulate business taxpayers, was their theory. So if you have, let's say your income's coming from a partnership or S corporation, and you go ahead and impose a tax on the partnership or S corporation that is paid. And in the Connecticut case, the partner or S corporation shareholder would get a credit against their state income taxes, representing, you know, an offset to take care of the fact that the entity had been had a tax imposed on it. Now, the IRS said, well, we're going to shut that down, too. They said at the same time, they said, we're going to shut down these credits. But although they moved with an analysis on the credits, they never really moved on this issue, right? Now, these state things went beyond Connecticut. We saw programs that went differently. For instance, we saw states adopt, like we see in New Jersey, a program where you opt into this. You don't have to pay this tax. You can decide to pay this tax. So it's optional. You know, we also saw states like Milwaukee, I would say Wisconsin, not Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the state, not the city, state of Wisconsin, where they said, well, what we're going to do is say, yes, you can elect in, but instead of giving you a credit against your taxes, we're just going to say that we're going to allow you to subtract out the pass-through income before you compute your tax on your state, on the state return. So we just won't have you pay tax individually to the state on this. The entity will have paid the tax for you. But because of that, of course, you effectively are going to still get the deduction. And then we've had various other variants with other states, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Rhode Island, New York, I believe, did it as well. You know, so we've had various odds on this. Well, the catch was, you know, while the IRS said it would not work, the IRS ended up with a problem. A lot of commentators began noting that it was going to be difficult for the IRS to come up with a theory to shut this down that was not going to run into trouble with pre-existing taxes like the California tax on LLCs, gross fees, or, you know, the Texas franchise tax, or, you know, New York State, the New York, whatever that tax is that the city of New York pulls off on unincorporated businesses. You know, those taxes, I mean, we've always thought those were fully deductible, you know, and that was years before, and they don't get any sort of odd credit or any other structure. And the other problem was, while the IRS could object to the fact that it's refundable, you know, let's say that you got a tax refund, well, then the fix would be to switch over and just make it like Wisconsin and say, nope, we're just going to get a subtraction from income because, hey, that's just having Wisconsin tax it like a C corp, right? And, you know, we've always had that historically. There, you know, there have been a few states that have not accepted S corporations or have allowed you to have an S corporation tax as a C. Or conversely, you know, I could say, and then you say, well, Wisconsin's problem is it's voluntary. Well, then, okay, let's have Wisconsin then adopt the Connecticut version. So if we did a program that was not voluntary, that had the pass-through entity tax in the same manner as a C corp, a pure entity, and therefore removed it from the calculation of individual state tax, you know, well, okay, that would work. And basically all the IRS would do by putting up those objections that could shut it down for those other issues is just convert them all over to something that would work and it would happen instantly. So the IRS decided now that, yeah, we're just giving up. They're through in the towel. So the IRS in Notice 2020-75 issued guidance that indicated that they will allow the deduction above the line for taxes imposed on the, for income style income taxes imposed on the entity at the entity level, as long as the entity is an S corporation or a partnership. Key warning, the notice does not discuss any such tax that might apply to a single member LLC. It is solely talking about S corps and partnerships. So, you know, if it's a single member LLC, it's not clear at this point that that guidance is going to offer relief there. And the IRS there may be playing on the whole line about disregarded entities. And their theory is if they allowed that, they would have to allow just a tax on a standard Schedule C without an LLC to happen. And, Yeah, they may decide that, nope, we're not going there, because then it seems like we could do all kinds of other things. So they may stick with that. It has to be an entity to do it. And they also said, though, yes, we're not going to worry about the fact, they said specifically, it does not matter if the tax is one you opt into. It does not matter if we get a credit for that tax, we apply against our state income taxes. It does not matter if we get an exclusion from income of the flow-through amount. Any of those, we're not challenging them. We're going to accept them. We are going to put out regulations shortly, proposed regs to do this. So the IRS has essentially given up on those taxes. Now, you might say, wait, but my state doesn't have one of those, so why would I care? My guess is we're going to see a lot more states start doing this now, especially if we do not see a repeal of the SALT cap. And my guess is I don't think we're going to see a repeal of the SALT cap. I thought it would have been iffy, you know, even if there had been 100% control in a blue wave. I think it would have still been tough because this is an expensive change. And there's a lot of money spending things that people want to do. And we've had put a lot into the economy for the COVID issue and that sort of thing. So I thought anybody wouldn't get it. And now that I think it's very likely that we are not going to see all of the government offices in control of the same party. You know, it's basically now, you know, we're going to say, seems like it's a pretty good shot. Well, actually, very good shot. The House is going to be in control of the Democrats. Seems like a pretty good shot. The president's going to be a Democrat. But it also seems like the Senate, you know, it's probably going to stay in Republican control unless the Democrats were to win both outstanding Senate seats in the runoff in Georgia coming up January 5th. And even if they pulled that off, they would just barely have a majority, which means any particular Democratic senator that did not want to go along with some program could kill it. And there's going to be Democratic senators who are going to be concerned about deficit issues. And yeah, so like I'm thinking the 10 grand cap's going to hang around. Could be totally wrong. I'm often wrong on these things, but I think it's going to hang around. And if it hangs around, I think you're going to see more states start adopting this program. Comes from the state standpoint, it's basically makes the state look a bit more competitive in a business context because it's the same tax, so it's not as if they're asking for more tax, but they do move it so that, you know, the people living in the state get more of a federal subsidy from that standpoint. There are some problems to work out for credits for taxes paid to other state to get an equivalency there, but I have a feeling if all the states start doing it, they're going to work out a method to make that work. So keep an eye on this. I suspect we will see more states doing it unless we see a repeal of the SALT cap. And even if we saw a repeal of the SALT cap, we might see people do this if the old AMT came back. Because again, above the line taxes did not cause us problems with AMT. Below the line taxes did. So interesting issue. Finally, let's talk about a case this week. This is Ball versus Commissioner TC Memo 2020-152. This is a kind of an interesting case. It came down on November the 10th of 2020. And, you know, so let's talk about this case, the Ball case. This is an IRA case. And a lot of times our clients don't realize that, you know, when you get a benefit like an IRA, we're going to have long-term tax-free growth of money. You have entered into kind of an arrangement. Congress and you have gotten a deal together. And while you might think of that as your money, okay, and it is your money in one sense, but if you do certain things with that money, then you're going to lose the special tax benefit. This taxpayer learned this the very hard way. This taxpayer apparently decided, you know, he had an IRA with Chase. I guess it was came from a SEP. An IRA with Chase. Well, apparently he wanted to make some private loans to private parties with his funds in the IRA. Now, we're not told in this case for sure if he asked Chase about whether they would hold that. But this appeared to be just a regular consumer IRA account. So we know pretty much the answer would be no, right? I mean, it'd even be difficult if you're willing to pay the Chase Bank Trust Department to handle your IRA as a full trust item. I have a feeling they would balk at these personal loan options because of the difficulty of valuation, and they do have to report values every year. So, you know, they would probably balk, and if they ever did it, they would charge a really high fee. That would make it not very economical to do. So what this gentleman decided to do is have Chase issue checks to him that he would deposit in a single member LLC, I'll get that out right, that he owned 100% of. Now, you know, the money came in. He got a check from Chase, and he just filled in a standard, you know, send me a check form. And, of course, he said it was a regular distribution, and it was subject to, you know, there was no known exception. But he took that money out of Chase. It went into this LLC and then instantly went out to the party that he was going to be loaning the money to. And he did two loans, so there were two big distributions. One of the loans got repaid early in 2013. This money came out in 12. The other one, there were payments being made. As the money came back in, he put the money back in the Chase IRA account. If the money came back in, you know, when the money came back in, he either flagged it as a rollover contribution to Chase, or he flagged it as a current year contribution. When it came time to do his 2012 return, not surprisingly, Chase issued 1099s for the 209,000 plus that he had received in these distributions he was throwing out to make these loans. And Chase's 5498 that was issued for the balance at the end of December, well, all it showed as balance in the IRA account was the approximately $55,000 that were the other investments that were left in the account. It did not include any of the notes. As you might guess, you know, taxpayer puts that down as a, you know, gross distribution 209 plus, then it says taxable distribution of zero. He's treating it effectively as a kind of rollover. Okay, the IRS, of course, gets this and they start matching up. You know, okay, I see 1099-R, I see a gross distribution, but I don't see anybody reporting a rollover of this number. The numbers don't work. So can you tell me, you know, they send out the CP2000. He, of course, doesn't respond. They go ahead and they assess the tax plus the, and it was about a $69,000 worth of tax plus the, the negligence, the penalty, the accuracy-related penalty for having a substantial understatement of tax, which is 20% of that tax, that amount. And, you know, he then objects and goes to tax court. Now, his claim was, you know, he had invested, he had the repayments. He's saying, this LLC acted as a conduit agency arrangement that I was acting on behalf of Chase. Now, the court said, actually, there are some cases where we've held that that's okay. You know, that funds may have temporarily touched what looked like an account under the control of the taxpayer, but was used just to get the money from, you know, one IRA into the other IRA with a temporary conduit arrangement. But the taxpayer, but the court said in this case, you know, this doesn't meet the requirements. They're saying, here's the problem. First thing is, it's tough to say this was an agency arrangement to enable the investment to be made out of the Chase accounts, you know, for Chase to still be the custodian of, because Chase had no idea what you were doing with this account. There's no sign whatsoever Chase ever considered this to be in their account. And there's no view whatsoever even asked Chase about it. They're saying, so this does not appear to be an agency matter. And even though when you know, your notes were saying that it was with your SEP account, they're saying, still, all this money was under your personal control. And you had total personal control. So, you know, and your SEP was not a qualified IRA custodian, to be totally honest. That's another problem you'd have in this thing. And Chase clearly is not the party saying they're holding it. So we're going to say it's taxable. Well, he did try one other option. He said, well, okay, but here's the catch. I never deposited any of the checks into an account in my name. The money went straight into an account that was an account owned by the LLC and then went into the loan. So since I never got the money, it can't possibly be taxable to me as a distribution. The tax court said, nah, that's not how that works. A distribution generally will be considered to be issued to the recipient will tend to be the person who has the right to receive it, right? The owner of the account. Yes, they said there have been some special cases where that's not the case, such as when a soon-to-be former spouse managed to raid the IRA account of the other spouse before the divorce got started without that person's knowledge. They said, okay, in that case, we agreed that that person was not the one to be deemed recipient. But merely you knowingly directing the funds to another party, nope, you're the recipient. So it held that this was taxable. The real takeaway from this case is to understand that there are rules here, right? And our clients, lots of times, you know, they're in an IRA, but they want to say, you know, they start chafing at this limitation because, you know, darn it, you know, Charles Schwab won't let me go buy a rental and stick it in the IRA. You know, they say they won't deal with that. And, you know, well, I should be able to do that. So I'm going to go out, I'm going to get a rental. But of course, you know, and then don't worry about it. I'll just put it in Charles Schwab's name without telling them, you know, or whatever, as custodian of the IRA. And, you know, we had a case almost exactly like that a couple of years ago, if you remember, we talked about on this program, where the taxpayer lost on that too. Taxpayers have to realize that IRAs and retirement accounts have very, very specific rules. And you've got to be very, very careful what you do with it. And as I would tell a client, you know, the advantage of using Chase or, you know, a standard Chase account or Bank America account or a, you know, Charles Schwab brokerage account, Fidelity account, is it's probably going to be the fees are going to be a lot lower than they would be if we went out and got a specialized trustee to do it. But the trade-off there is that those companies do those nice low fees because you've given them relatively simple assets to deal with. Well, if you want to have a more complicated, messy asset where there are risks of having, you know, problems we can run into there with, we talk about prohibited transaction issues, you know, if there's a improper relationship, if it's dealt with, is there some benefit to you that we have to worry about all those things? Well, you're going to pay a whole lot more to have an account like that work, and it's going to be very, very easy to accidentally blow it up. So you've got to probably pay, not only get the custodian in there who you're going to pay decent fees to, but you're probably also going to have legal counsel that's going to have to come in every time you do anything to verify you're not causing a problem. So mechanically, you know, it makes an IRA a bad area to do this, even if it is not technically like a collectible that's barred from you having in the IRA. But it's like it's still going to be one of those that just mechanically it's not going to make economic sense. So be careful of that. You know, you all know those clients who chafe at that, who don't want the government telling them what to do. And I say, well, that's fine. But if you don't want the government telling you what to do, then don't get into a government program. You know, that's kind of the change. If you're in a government program, the government will tell you what to do. If you don't want the government to tell you what to do, you can invest these funds on your own. Now, they're going to tax you on them, right? Because they're going to tax any income, but you will have total freedom to do what you want. There's your choices. And sometimes clients don't like to hear things like that. They want the good side, you know, the reduction of taxes, all the tax breaks, but they don't want to hear about the part that those breaks are only available if you agree to play by the government's rules. And in this case, obviously not playing by government's rules turned out to be very expensive for this taxpayer because, by the way, did not get out of the penalty either. You know, the court found that he had no reasonable basis for the position he took. And so because of that, tough luck. You owe the 20% penalty on the, you know, on top of the tax you're going to pay plus the interest. I do have a couple of webcasts coming up with the New Jersey Society of CPAs over the next couple of weeks. The first one will be coming up this coming Wednesday. We'll be doing an 8-hour session for current federal tax development, so we'll take you up with the updates there, what's happened just very recently in taxes from the latter part of last year all the way through to today. So probably looking at the SECURE Act and other big things that have happened. Then on the 30th of November, I will be doing what's going to be a session on the PPP loan program. The forgiveness application will be a 4-hour version of the program. And we'll talk about, you know, all the issues arising. And who knows, we may have some guidance on this deductions of expenses by then. Again, if you want to sign up for those, they're both webcasts. You can sign up for them on the website for njcpa.org. You can search for them. And you should be able to sign up if you're a member of the New Jersey Society of CPAs. You obviously get the member discount. If not, you'll have to pay the full price. But, you know, it should qualify for CPE for CPAs for anybody around the country who wants to take it. And obviously you can, you know, like I said, it's webcast, so it's not as if you all have to pick up and fly over to, you know, to the Newark, New Jersey area and meet me in the, you know, in Roseland at the New Jersey Society offices. Actually, the first course here, which has been scheduled for all year, as I recall, was planned initially to be in Roseland, but obviously, we're not going to hold it in Roseland. You know, it's going to be kind of broadcast again. So you could be virtual anywhere. Again, this has been Current Federal Tax Developments. We're going to have this every week as we look at what's happening during the week. We're approaching the Thanksgiving period, so I suspect things may slow down a little bit. I won't expect much for the week of Thanksgiving. Next week, we may see a few new things come out. And again, we might see that guidance on how we might see the proposed regs on the state and local taxes, which might give us a few more details. And we might see the guidance on that deduction when you haven't yet had the forgiveness. So we'll take a look, watch for that, plus any other things. We'll see if they actually decide to do something in a lame duck Congress, because that'll be something. But they almost certainly, they're not going to come back, I suspect, until early December. I doubt they're going to rush in here, so we'll probably have plenty of time before any lame duck thing gets done, if they are going to do something in December. But we'll talk about that if that happens. You can follow me on Twitter at Ed Zollers. I'm also follow the Connect sites for the CPA societies for Arizona, Illinois, Minnesota, New Jersey, and Washington. If you're a member of those societies, you can go ahead onto their Connect websites, and you should be able to, in the discussions, post any issues or questions. I do try to follow those, so if you say something there, I'll try to catch it, and if I think I can add to the conversation, I will. Otherwise, you know, have a good week. And we'll see you next week with hopefully a brand new set of fun stuff happening here for current federal tax developments.